Welcome to today's SNEB webinar, organized by the Healthy Aging and the Research Divisions. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB, and so glad you're joining us. A little bit of housekeeping. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see a handout tab, and the slides for today's presentation are there for you to download. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block so we can moderate those to our presenter. There will be a short survey when I close out the webinar, and in the survey, we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as any suggestions for future sessions. And then watch for an email. That should be maybe not until Monday, with a link to the recording, the handouts, and the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. And so I'll introduce our moderator. Allie Berg is Associate Professor and Extension Nutrition and Health Specialist at the University of Georgia. She is also Chair of the Healthy Aging Division.
Thank you, Rachel. I appreciate that. Welcome, everyone. I'm excited to have you all here today to join our webinar that is jointly hosted by the Healthy Aging Division and the Research Divisions of SNEB. And we're really excited to have this very unique presentation from Dr. Shin-Chi Dong today. So before we get started, I wanted to share with you the nutrition educator competencies that we will be covering today and just give you a little perspective on how Dr. Dong is going to address these. So the first one is in the basic food and nutrition knowledge arena to describe the basic types of approaches used by researchers to study diet and health relationships and describe their advantages and limitations. And Dr. Dong is going to discuss the types of studies that he uses to address health among older adults and all adults, particularly longitudinal epidemiological studies. And these are important for understanding really the complex nature of diet-related diseases that we as nutrition educators seek to prevent and treat. The second competency is in the behavior and education theory arena, and he's going to talk about, or that's to describe the various determinants of eating behavior and the associated opportunities and barriers to achieving optimal health and quality of life. And so many of you work in environments where it is very clear that there are social determinants of health. And we've been talking about this a lot with our Healthy Aging Division recently, and it's important that we understand these determinants as they really impact whether or not our clientele can receive and implement nutrition education and other types of health education. And so Dr. Dong's career has focused at least in partly in elucidating some of these determinants and then how they can be addressed. And lastly, the last competency is in the area of communication on communicate effectively in written, visual, and oral form with individuals, the media, and other groups in ways that are appropriate for diverse audiences. And in Dr. Dong's research, as you'll learn, it's imperative to keep participants engaged over very long periods of time. And then he's really figured out ways to effectively communicate with his participants in ways that are meaningful to them and really keep them coming back to participate. I know you're going to be really impressed with his retention data. And we all know that recruitment and retention are a challenge, whether you're in research or education or practice. And so his lessons learned can really help us effectively communicate with our clientele to create those long-term connections. So with that, I'll just give his brief bio as he requested. Dr. Shin-Chi Dong is the director of the Institute for Health, Healthcare Policy and Aging Research at Rutgers University. Dr. Dong is a population health epidemiologist and geriatrician and has published extensively on violence prevention, elder justice, and healthy aging. And he has spent his career engaging minority communities in research and health education. And with that, I will turn it over to you, Dr. Dong. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Allison. And thanks, everyone, for joining and for co-sponsoring this event. You know, when I was thinking about this, nutrition is so much more than just nutrition, as your audience inevitably understands. You know, in many ways, it's the glue that binds many aspects of well-being together. You know, needless to say, all of you, and certainly for me, that some of my fondest memories are surrounding food. And I joke with my kids to say, you know, if one day I weren't able to eat, those are the things I want in my G-tube, and I want to have those in this frequency basis. All joking aside, I think when we talk about minority researcher and retention, and at least in our Asian communities, more specifically some of our recent work in Chinese communities, when we talk to participants about food, their eyes light up, right? They begin to talk about their social connectedness. They talk about family. They talk about their psychosocial well-being. It's also when people opens up in a way that surprises many of us. When I see patients, when it's a difficult moment or when they have trouble, you know, talking about a specific issue, sometimes talking about culture, talking about traditions, and sometimes talking about food, make them reminiscent of the past times and get into a place where people are willing to talk about perhaps more difficult things. So I think about nutritional research education, I think there's so much more potential that we have not tapped into. So I really very much welcome this opportunity to talk about this with you. Next slide. So a little bit about the Institute. It's the hub for translational research. I won't read the slides, but we have, you know, about 150 members from 30 different schools and units across Rutgers. We have 30 plus universities, national, international, that we collaborate with. We have six faculty who are members of the National Academy of Medicine. But one of the most important things that we do is really leverage the theory-based research to impact practice and policy, and to do so through community engagement, through actively engaging with our participants and our population in a way that we can really understand what is going on and how to do research better. Next slide. PINE study started more than a decade ago back. It started from a pilot project, and one of the impetus for the PINE study was really through a number of and series of unfortunate community events. And, you know, when things happen in Chinatown, for example, many decades ago back, you know, we would go to our aldermen, we would go to our congressmen, we'll go to our senators, we would say, you know, we can't believe those things happen, we need more resources. You know, usually the first thing they tell us is that, I'm sorry, this is happening to you. But almost inevitably, the second thing they say is that, show me the data. They're asking, why should the squeaky wheel get the oil? What resources should I take away from other organizations in a setting of a limited budget to be able to give to you, in this case, the Chinese community? And group of community leaders and advocates and policymakers, we really got tired of asking those questions. In many ways, that's how PINE study was born. By getting community level data, in-depth data that supports our needs. And that's really how PINE study was really started, that we have some of the highest burden in mental health disparities. Chinese elderly have some of the highest suicide rates of all racial ethnic populations. And the issue of stress, family violence disproportionately affects us. Certain type of cancer disproportionately affects the community. So the gap has been vast, but there really hasn't been a way systematically to document those through longitudinal study design. Next slide. And the reason for longitudinal study is that, you know, we hear a lot about the cross-sectional design, small sample sizes, and those are important studies, but it doesn't get at causality. It doesn't get at what causes what. We only know what's associated with what or what's correlated with what. Until we can understand what causes what, we don't know how to intervene. And that's why we, in part, why the longitudinal study is so important. We collect a lot of data. Each survey is about an hour and a half to 2 hours, and we ask very in-depth information. Next slide. And we recruit across the Chicago area. Inevitably, in Chicago, there are two Chinatowns. There's the Chinatown, sort of the little thin, the symbol look like one, near the middle of the graph, and then there's the sort of north side of Chinatown. Those are the two heavily populated areas. And what we did is we did a number of studies to really look at the sampling strategies. To do a sampling strategy of geographically defined population that's nested within large metropolitan cities, it's improbable to do. And so what we did is twofold. We did a random block census study, and then we also looked at census data to look at demographic trends and characteristics, whether that differ from the study population that we enrolled. Next slide. We work with a lot of community organizations. You know, one organization we partner with closely was called Chinese American Service League. And it's the largest social services agency in the Midwest. And it started with a very targeted community advisory board meeting that we had. I remember, I tell the story, I haven't told it for some time, that we sat in a room of probably about 20 community leaders. And we started talking, and we leveraged the CBPR principle, which I'll talk about in a second. And, you know, we were really there to listen. There's so much history about the sentiments of parachute researchers go into a community, take something out and never return. We often call them in and out researchers. And then never really leave the community with sustainable resources to enable their own needs. And through the principle CBPR, as was first starting out, we simply listened. And it wasn't until one elderly man who sat in the advisory board meeting, and we had been in Chinese, in Mandarin, Cantonese, and we had translators there who were able to do all of those dialects. And we listened in a room about 20 people, and there was probably about a couple of minutes of silence. You know, it can be very uncomfortable, but it was necessary for us to hear what was going on and what were people thinking. And after about a minute or two of silence in a large boardroom of 20 people, a Chinese elderly man said, "Dr. Dong, is duck feed high in trans fat?" It surprised a lot of people. It didn't necessarily surprise me as much because, you know, issues in nutrition and food. We started talking about, you know, what is fat, what is trans fat, what are ruminant animals, and how does it? It was through the food and nutrition we start talking about health. And then we started dissecting what are the concepts of health. Is it nutritional health? Is it, you know, spiritual health? Is it mental health? Is it social health? Is it physical health? And from there, we started unfold talking about what are the things community needs before I had any, you know, assumptions about what the community needs or our investigators think about what the community needs. So that's how sort of the study started. And we actively engaged in multiple social services, senior partners, social clubs, faith-based organizations. And we did a study announcement. Community leaders shot videos with us to vouch for us. We were able to stand in front of the church podiums, talk about our study. Our community leaders went to vouch for us in a way that I had never expected. They went to knock on doors with us. You know, those are the trusted member of the community. But it took enormous time to build that. And those steps, those really, you know, endless after hours, evenings and weekends and knocking on doors and having those listening meetings were truly instrumental for us to think about, you know, what were the right ingredients to set the stage to so that we can really have an equal partnership. Next slide. So we had over 3,000 people. By that time, that was, you know, I think to this date is the largest cohort study of Chinese elderly in the Western Hemisphere, other than studies outside of China, you know, China. And so we had average age of about 72. So anybody 60 and over, we enrolled. We had people from 60, we had people to over 100 who were enrolling the studies, and about 59%. Female average education is about 8.7, and the vast majority of people had income less than 10,000. So they're fairly poor socioeconomic status. About 71% people were married. Next slide. I talked about this, and I think, you know, there's mistrust were deep, and this is not just in, you know, historically talked about African-American Hispanic community, but it's in Asian community as well. And I think lack of time, resources, scientific tools, analytical expertise as a part of that, I became very engaged with community organizations. I joined some of the governing boards of some of the organizations, and really putting my time and putting my sweat in very earlier days. And that was necessary because I needed to show my face. I needed to let the community know that this is more than just a project, that this is really our long-term investment in the community, at least from my perspective. Next slide. I talked about this already. I want to go into the next slide. So one of the things we did is that after we collected the baseline data for more than 3,100 Chinese elderly, we made a promise to our community that we would, you know, give the data back to our community before we published scientific papers. And that's precisely what we did. We analyzed the data. Pine Reports was the first report that talked about longevity-related issues. And we got people together. We did a lot of didactic sessions. We talked about what they reported in aggregate levels. We talked about subgroup differences. The filial piety report was a subsequent study looking at adult children of older adults, you know, filial piety, but those who may not know, it's a Confucius principle that dictates what does elderly expect from their children? What does children expect from elderly? It's really a bidirectional, you know, there's a saying of all virtues in the world, filial piety is the most important. And to this day remain the case, although evidence suggests that there's been some shifts with respect to intergenerational solidarities in the contemporary environment. Next slide. So in the U.S. Census, I already talked about this a bit as well. We had about 17,000 residents, and out of the 17,000 residents in Chicago, there's probably about 6,000-7,000 elderly, and we enrolled half of them, you know, which was really a tremendous feat. And I think to this day, and when we have sampling like this and being confirmed by random block census looking at the U.S. Census data, we felt very confident that that our data are truly representative of the Chicago Chinese population. Next slide. We've gone through a lot of different waves. I won't go through this. You can have those data to look at detail. We follow people continuously over time every 2 years. I think the next slide is a follow-up rate that you can show. As people were passing away, that we enrolled successive cohort, new immigrants who were coming to Chicago, Chinatown and communities, people who were under 60 who became 60 years old, and we enrolled successive cohort people to ensure that sample size remained large. We learned a lot of things from this initial phases of the study. That CBPR was an effective approach, and it demands extra culturally sensitive measures, not only in terms, we talked about a lot about different survey constructs to say, you know, should we collect information on suicide? Is that too sensitive? How do we frame it? How do we set the preambles to minimize some of the assumptions and stigma and taboo talking about those issues? Empower the community to really understand their own strength and limitations as well. And it's not always easy to talk about those things. Imagine as researchers say, well, you should think about this. We couldn't do that, nor do we want to ever do that. But make sure they understand how does that, you know, each of our strengths and weaknesses are unique, and I think complement each other in a way that moves the field forward. Next slide. I think that we've written about this with respect to culture humility. We've written some of the very specific about framework to say, how do you leverage culture humility? People talk about culture competency all the time in the healthcare professional medical school training. And despite its importance, we see a lot of limitations in culture competency training. You know, one of the framework that I give is that, well, you know, even in Chinese culture, there are more than 50 minority groups. There are 2 million Muslims in China. How could I be truly competent about all of the different aspects of Chinese culture just because of a Chinese name and I speak Chinese? Doesn't necessarily mean I understand everything. And so competence in many ways implies something which we may or may not be able to achieve, nor should we think that it's necessary. But through the lens of culture humility, we can understand, acknowledge, deepen trust. Next slide. we've had pretty successful follow-up wave rates. You can see that through the data that's shown here. That's not without a lot of work. We keep in touch with our community participants on a regular basis. We do newsletters. We send them follow-up. We send them birthday cards. We send them calendars. We keep in touch with them. We host community events. You know, and we invite them to things. You know, every year when we have our annual benefit dinner, we would invite some of our participants. We have some huge mega families, you know, who have enrolled in our study. We have participants, families with more than 10, 15, 20 people in singular family who have joined Pine Study. And so in many ways that they're connected to us in so many different levels. And one of the very sad story, we you know, sometime participants inevitably pass away, and we've had a number of stories of our participants talking about Pine Study as the as a way of acknowledging their existence, acknowledging their pain and suffering and their joy. And we have family members who keep in touch with us after their loved one passed away, saying that, you know, my mom and dad really talk so highly about the Pine Study and being connected with you, and for your team to be able to, you know, understand much more deeply than sometimes family themselves understood the elderly, because in the setting of privacy, sometimes it's easier to talk about difficult issues with a stranger that you may be able to trust than sometimes family members. And we all find that to be the case occasionally. Next slide. There's certainly challenges for retention. People move, and people cognition change, and sometimes family circumstances change. So it's, you know, no study can follow people 100%. But we do try to keep in touch with people as much as we can. And for people who move out of state, we try to use phone interviews. Even when they move to China, if we can keep in touch with them, we do WeChat interviews. But sometimes people move away that we don't know and don't know how to get a hold of them. And sometimes people pass away that we don't know they have passed away. So we try to leverage different modalities and through innovation, trying to understand people's vital status and trying to use reverse engineering, trying to keep track of people that we can find and leverage family and friends and neighbors and organizations to see how we can keep connected with our participants. Next slide. Community impact. I like to think we've made some community impact. You know, the difference between survey research and clinical trials is that clinical trials often you can see much more immediate impact. For survey research takes time. I think we need to be very clear with our participants, especially in minority participants, that it's not going to change your life right away. You know, and I think often false promises and prophecy can get us into deeper water and weakening that trust over time. And this is one of the participant quote, I can read it out. You need to provide participants with instructions after the survey, let them know, actually see the benefit of participation. With a clear directions, the number of participants increase has to be relevant to community needs. So as much as Pine Study is a research study, you know, many community organizations use that as a needs assessment. You know, now when we go to our mayors and go to our aldermen and congressmen and senators, it's not just about the fact that we have those end of one stories. Now we have reports. We have hard data to be able to demonstrate to the organizations. And some of the most rewarding thing is when I hear from community leaders who goes down to Springfield, our capital in Illinois, to say, you know, when I go down there, give a brief briefing, hear a briefing, I bring my one-page brief and I bring a copy of Pine and Piety reports with them. And that gives me enormous joy to hear that people are really using those reports to enable their community needs, to find the needs that they can help with their participants and community at large. Next slide. Why don't we minimize here, Lincoln? That's the end of my talk, and love to entertain questions. Good, Allison, I see you, so go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was a great presentation. You went through quite a bit quickly, so I'm sure my colleagues are digesting and If you can see the question box, you can put your questions in that box and I will moderate those questions. But I'll start off with one while maybe people are getting warmed up. You spoke today about the concept of cultural competency versus cultural humility, and that is not something I had heard of before today's presentation. So would you mind kind of revisiting that a little bit and sort of unpacking that for us a little more, and why that may be relevant to our roles?
Right. You know, cultural competency trainings historically in the healthcare profession education, in medical school education, implies that we should be, that we could be competent about a specific culture. And I think while the framework is understandable, it makes it very difficult to understand that concept to be, what does it mean to be competent? What does it mean? How do you define it? How do you measure it? And it's very difficult. I think the culture humility training, if you search my name and put in the culture humility, you'll find an article that we wrote that specifically talk about that framework. It's really a different way of willingness to listen, willingness to engage in a dialogue, acknowledging culture differences and culture values, and come to consensus in terms of that physician-patient, that nurse-patient, that nutritionist-patient relationship. And I think it's that lens that I think we can go much further in terms of understanding community needs and building trust between patients and the healthcare system and their providers in a way that perhaps the cultural competence training may or may not be able to provide. And I'm not saying that we should abandon cultural competency training. I'm suggesting cultural humility training could be a good supplement towards the traditional cultural competency training to take one a step deeper, if you will, into understanding cultural values, intergenerational relationships, understanding what are the issues that really influence family relationships and decision making. Let me give you an example. In Chinese culture, it's not uncommon when the elderly to be diagnosed with cancer for families to withhold that diagnosis from the patients. It's not uncommon for when patients receive chemotherapy to be told that they're receiving intravenous hydration. Now, in the traditional autonomous rights to self-determination, you may see all sort of flags that raises from that. But that may not be the case in Chinese culture. I think we, through the lens of cultural humility, we can understand a bit more. And the premise of those often family decisions is the is a sense of paternalistic view to protect the suffering from older adults. Now, does it mean the older adults completely unaware of the issues they go through? Not necessarily, you know. But I think understand those values may prevent us from having premature judgments about issues of decision capacity, autonomy, the rights to self-determination in the traditional Western paradigm.
Thank you for that explanation. That, I think that's really relevant to us as nutrition educators, you know, practitioners, as well as we think about how we approach our education and assumptions that we might make about people and their culture and different practices. So hopefully that kind of information can help us be more sensitive practitioners. I'm going to look up that citation and maybe we can share it with our viewers today. Okay, so we have a question from the audience that says, what are your future plans for the PINE study or other research studies with the same demographic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, PINE study, we have sister studies in other parts of the world as well that we are engaging. PINE study is continuing. We are in the middle of the sixth wave of the PINE study right now. We plan to go to the seventh wave to start really collecting biological, physiological markers, actigraphy, physical activity data, you know, genetic information, epigenetic information. So I think we are taking it much deeper for the PINE study. But we're also, if you were to search on the web, looking at in New Jersey, the New Jersey population cohort study. We're about to start a study in New Jersey for a large sample size of aiming to be about 10,000 people with the representative sampling, something funded by the Robert Johnson Foundation. One of the unique studies features is that we are planning to enroll about 8 different immigrant groups. New Jersey is very rich in diverse populations. And among those different immigrant groups, we also plan to enroll multi-generational families as well. and to understand intergenerational relationships through a very different way. And we plan to do all sort of data linkages to claims data, to environmental data, to health service utilization data, to neighborhood safety data, social deprivation index, and all sort of other things. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that's coming down the line that I'm very thrilled about.
That's really impressive. I'm glad you have a very large team to help you get everything done. So our next question is, how do you maintain funding over time?
It takes a lot of effort. You know, we've been very fortunate to be able to conduct those studies. Many other longitudinal study have not been as blessed. It takes a good team. I think it takes a lot of trying. We apply for grants all the time, even though we've been continuously funded. We never miss a grant cycle. And we apply for multiple sources. We leverage NIH, other DHHS, foundations, philanthropy to be able to support the work that we do. But it's not easy under any circumstances.
Okay. With regard to communicating with your participants, you know, you made a point that it's really important that you committed to them to put those study reports out first before you published. And I was curious if there were certain methods that you have found to be most effective for communicating your results or just communicating your work with your participants to keep them engaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think be able to, you know, when we do the reports, we always do them in the native language. And I try to do them, almost all of them, myself. And since I'm the lead of the study and I have sense of ownership, I think engaging community organization help you to co-sponsor those events are very helpful. So we really, I don't think we had any session where we're done in the university. I think almost all of our events were done in community organization in the grand halls of you know, organizations, churches, senior apartments. So we bring the presentation to them, not for them to come to us to do them. And we need to keep on hammering them. Sometimes we have fantastic showing, and sometimes you only get a couple of dozen people, and that's okay. You know, as much as everybody wants a large audience, and sometimes it's those smaller formats that gives you the most deepest insight and input on what that means, as opposed to having 100 people where nobody speaks up, but you get the number. So the number is not necessarily the most important thing. It's really show that sense that, you know, we did what we're supposed to do. We kept to our words. We kept to our promises. And I think just showing our face in many ways means a lot.
Great, thank you. So we have another question that's, how do you see the aspects of culture changing in the future? Understanding that cultural awareness and humility is imperative, the evolution of a culture might not be readily apparent. How could we approach and refine our understanding?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a bit of a, you know, scientific theoretical question, a bit of a philosophical point as well. And I think about that, and I don't have the answer to it in short, but the things I think about are, you know, how do we define culture? But culture change, you know, constantly over time. If I were to ask my parents about what they think that what defines the Chinese culture to my grandparents, their parents, they will say something probably very different than what I ask my children as defined as Chinese culture. So I think cultural values do change over time. The modernization, industrialization of our societies forces our culture to change. And the historical paradigm of obligations, because what is culture, right? Culture is just traditions, traditionally defined by a group of people that think that somehow it's relevant to their existence. And as demographic change, as geography change, as migration patterns change, so does culture. So it's not a static thing. I think this is why measuring it through longitudinal studies are enormously important, because we can capture that, because otherwise we can only get anecdotal stories through focus groups over time. It doesn't quite have the power of quantitative research. But quantitative research have a lot of limitations as well, because we can't measure, you know, 20 different cultural values. We can measure some of them, but we may miss some as well. And so I think there's really a role for mixed method study, that's what I'm trying to say, to really be able to capture that and use the iterative process of understanding, you know, qualitative research to be able to reinforce to say, what else do we, can we capture through survey research? But, you know, unless, I mean, if we lock somebody in a room for 5 hours, we can ask them 1,000 questions, but we can't do that, right? So we have to think about fatigue and other issues relating to the complexity of survey research. So, but the question is really is important, and we struggle thinking about that, and not just the theoretically, philosophically, but, you know, measurement perspective as well, scientifically.
Great, thank you. So you, excuse me, you mentioned that you've known your participants to take the data and to actually, you know, go to Capitol Hill and try to work to obtain services for their community. So what kind of social determinants maybe has your research uncovered within this population that your community has then been able to go and get services to help address?
Mm-hmm. I think certainly documenting some of the mental health needs, social needs, has been really important. Insurance information to be able to drive for their own needs, understanding, because in the Pine study, we do collect quite a bit of nutritional data as well. For those of you who know the, you know, some many nutritional assessment can be very detailed. So we do collect some nutritional data, and some of this has been used as well. But I think in general is the community sentiment is that because we collect such in-depth data, more so than most survey researcher out there of any study, simply by just looking at the amount of survey content that you see from on the slides earlier, that people find different things in different needs. Some of the faith-based organizations look at concept religiosity, participation in religious services, how does that impact their, you know, needs. To some of the four social service organizations looking at disability, for example, looking at people with dementia or cognitive impairments or disease burdens more specifically to say, I need to apply for, you know, Alzheimer's disease funding because our participant rate for dementia is much higher or cognitive impairment is much higher. So people use them for different needs. And I think that's what's unique about the Pine and Piety report, because there's such breadth and depth, people can adapt it to whatever their community voice and needs may be.
Great, thank you. And so have there been any specific nutrition-related issues that you've uncovered that you would hope that maybe some of our nutrition educators could help you address with your community?
Interestingly, I mean, some. I think, you know, that, for example, there are the issues of oil we talk about, intake, not just through the surveys, but through some of the quantitative studies that, you know, this is more than just Chinese population. People think if you use olive oil, it's, you know, it's the next best thing, right? In a Mediterranean study and everything else. And some of the things we talk about, also surrounding the 10 myth study of aging, and many of them are nutritional ones. So if you take olive oil, for example, there's a lot of myth that say, well, gee, if I use olive oil, I must be healthy. Well, not so much. Olive oils in study that have been used are really freshly pressed olive oils that degrades over time. So after about 2 to 3 sometimes weeks, the phenol content decreases substantially, you know, the half-life decreases. So by the time you get it, you know, most people's olive oil really doesn't have any benefits of the traditional Mediterranean diets that you be able to think about. Also, people think that, you know, especially in Chinese population, you know, with the stir fry, they want the oil to be really, really hot. And sometimes when you burn oil at that temperature, there's some, you know, inadvertently adverse effects associated with that, especially with olive oil in this case. So if you go to our IFH website, we do have a talk that I give last year on 10 myths in aging, talk about all sort of nutritional stuff. So olive oil is one of those things. We talk a lot about things like red wine, you know, in terms of people think, well, drink a couple of glasses of wine, we'll solve all your problems. So apple a day, keep the doctors away. And then until when you look at some of the studies, looking at exactly the phenol content of the alcohol for you to be able to get the same benefit the study originated, you would have to drink probably about 15 bottles of wine per day to be able to get to that effect. So again, a lot of common myth associated with that. Avocado is a big one in Chinese culture. People think about, you know, I think avocado, but, you know, yes, there's a lot of good fat in there, but But everything, anything extreme can be deleterious and detrimental to health and well-being. You know, we talk about things like white meat versus dark meat. There's a lot of assumption that what dark meat, that's bad for you, right? But when you look at exactly the myoglobin content and nutritional value versus white meat versus dark meat, they really are not that much different. And the research studies are very much out there in terms of what are the benefits. Things like diet soda, it's one of my pet peeves to talk about the diet soda. You know, people have a Big Mac and then have a diet soda, say, hey, I had a relatively healthier meal, right? But in fact, when you think about diet soda and the metabolites it goes through, really has a lot of detrimental side effects. And with respect to metabolic syndrome and the conversions of dietary components. So I think, so there are many things out there nutritionally that we like to debunk. On their IFH website, maybe Dan can send you that on the talk that I give. There's a slide deck in there too that talks about 10 common myths in aging, and I think about 7 of those slides are relating to nutritional content.
Right. So we just had several other, your team is putting some great links in here to help our audience link to some of the reports that you've discussed or studies. So one question is, what do you think are the most important future directions of nutrition research to inform population health, especially among immigrant populations?
Yeah, one of the studies we haven't gotten funded to do, we'd love to be able to get funding to do, it's a look at role of gut permeability in microbiomes. Some of the researchers are already embarking up on that on a small scale level. But I think to do the large population scale, I think that holds enormous potential. I think so many of our disease processes are from what we put in our mouth, right? But so little is known exactly how that happens. It's not just fat content. Not everybody who eats high fat diets gets obese, right? Not everybody who are skinny who have healthy diets are necessarily healthy. So there's a lot of variations in that. I think gut microbiome and gut permeability and role for inflammatory pathways really have a lot of potential to be able to understand nutritional issues at large population scale level, especially looking at different nutritional patterns in immigrant groups, right? I mean, our cultures are so different. Our diet is enormously different. Wouldn't it be awesome to be able to think about a study that really gets at microbiomes and how they're linked to physiological health and physical health?
Great. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to just think I have gotten all the questions. Are there any other takeaways that you just really hope people glean from your presentation today or the work that you've done that we can employ?
No, I think it's great. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak to all of you about this and hope everyone stays safe and be well.
Thank you. I think, I want to just thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I mean, you've had quite an eminent career and your research is extremely valuable for all the people on this call and our organization at large and for the population. So just thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Dong. And thank you to Dan Dykewald and Dr. Dan Dykewald and your team at Rutgers. They've all been really, really helpful in getting everything together today. And so with that, I believe I'll turn it over to Rachel to do some final housekeeping.
Thank you. Excellent presentation. Just a reminder, when I close out the webinar, there'll be a short survey. We appreciate your feedback on this session. And then watch for an email follow-up. There's been some links posted in the chat, but I'll make sure those get in the follow-up email as well. And then just a reminder, this session actually was a great tie-in to the journal club this semester, which is looking at research methods. So please look at the SNEB website for upcoming journal club webinars. We did a presentation on utilizing large data sets earlier this week. So as always, the SNEB website is the best place to look for upcoming webinars. So we hope to see you back online soon. Thank you all very much.
Okay, bye-bye.